Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 11th, 2021. And I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And before we dive into today's episode, I want to thank those of you who continue to make Talk Nerdy possible through your generous support. You can visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge any dollar amount to support the show. This week's top pledges include Leonard Prince, Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so, so, so very much. All right, let's just dive into it. This is a real good one, you guys. I'm thrilled because I got to talk to one of my good friends. We've been putting it off because we were hoping to do it in person, but I'm glad that we finally were able to just suck it up and do this pandemic style remotely. But he is Dr. Shane Campbell-Staton, and he's an assistant professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and the Institute for Society and Genetics at the University of California, Los Angeles, of course, UCLA. He's also the co-host and co-creator of the Biology of Superheroes podcast. Guys, it's so good. And we talk about so many different things, from the evolution of pathogens, including the new COVID-19 strain, to the biology of superheroes, to how poaching elephants in Mozambique is leading to tusk loss. There's an actual evolutionary effect there. And also the dark history of science that shapes modern experiences of Black researchers. It really runs the gamut. It's a fascinating chat. I know you're going to love Shane as much as I do. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. Shane Campbell-Staton. Well, Shane, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. We've been talking about this for a while. I'm excited that we actually get to jump in and talk nerdy.
Oh my gosh, I think it's been like at least a year that we've been like, when are we going to sit down and record? And I really wanted to do it in person because we both live in LA. And I mean, like, I think we had Thanksgiving dinner together last year. But of course, because of the pandemic, we're having to do it remotely.
Yes. Now we are living in the aftertime. people only exist in two dimensions now.
Oh my God. I know, it's so strange. But either way, I'm so glad we're doing this. And of course, it is now, it's not as of this recording, but it is as of its airing, 2021. Thank goodness.
The new year. Although people, you know, I feel like people have been talking about, like, oh my God, I can't wait till 2021. Like, somehow, like at the threshold, like the stroke of midnight, everything is going to reset and there's not going to be a pandemic anymore. And, you know, the presidency is going to be automatically, you know, like all of those issues are going to be solved at the stroke of midnight. But I am looking forward to 2021 because, if anything, I'm just tired of 2020, quite frankly.
Oh my God, I know. It's like the dumpster fire will still be smoldering, but maybe, or at least maybe by January 20th, it will be not in full flames anymore. Mm-hmm. But gosh, it's true. The vaccine rollout is still in its infancy. You know, it's going to take months before we reach herd immunity if people are willing to get vaccinated. We're still in the after times a little bit. And I don't know if we'll ever get back to the before times.
Yeah, I think it's going to take a while for recovery. I mean, we've never seen anything like this, you know, and I don't think none of the infrastructure is prepared for anything like this because we never thought it was going to be a thing, you know. Well, at least politicians never thought it was going to be a thing. But we won't get too deep into that.
But you probably, I mean, you're not a virologist or an epidemiologist, but as an evolutionary biologist and one that really knows a lot about ecology, about survival, or, you know, the lack of survival of species, the idea of large pandemics or just, you know, widespread disease is a pretty common experience if you look back on geologic time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, some of, you know, when you're talking about, you know, like the spread of you know, of parasites of any sort, right? I mean, there's always, you know, under, you know, quote unquote normal, what people call normal circumstances is typically when you're like not talking about humans, because we kind of do our own thing with respect to the environment. You know, typically there's a balancing effect, right? You know, there's a system of checks and balances where you get, you know, really high densities because of those high densities in a wild population. The rate of infection of any given infective agent can spread more quickly, therefore reducing, you know, the population size. But because the population size reduces, right, then the infection rate begins to slow down, and you kind of have this equilibrium of, you know, of infection and sort of population rebound. But with humans, I mean, it's a little bit different because, you know, well, what is supposed to be the case in terms of morality is like, you know, human life is sacrosanct, right? And we should be able to do anything that we possibly can to save lives. And, you know, we occur in really large densities all over the globe. And therefore, anything that's able to, you know, infiltrate our species, right, in terms of pathogens, I mean, once they get in, right, they have kind of free roam. There's all of this what we call ecological niche space, right, to fill, where you can just jump in and go, right? And we see that over and over again. A lot of zoonotic diseases jump from, you know, other species to humans, and then, you know, you get things like coronavirus.
Yeah. And fascinatingly, I've been thinking a lot about the way that those pathogens themselves then have their own evolutionary pressures. And, you know, we've seen classic examples with antibiotic resistant bacteria that are actually evolving to be able to sort of survive our best drugs in many ways naturally. Well, it's all kind of naturally, artificially. That's a weird question, but in many ways naturally, but in many ways because of the way that we have tried to kill them off. And I was just presenting on the SGU this week, which will be last week for our listeners. There's a lot of time traveling when you record podcasts 2 weeks early. But about the new mutant version, I think B117 is what it's called, of coronavirus from the UK. There's also one in South Africa right now. And that even though we don't know exactly why it ended up with 23 mutations so quickly, whereas, you know, the mutation rate of most of the strains of coronavirus have been slower. Viruses are always mutating, but this one mutated really fast. Some of the hypotheses that have been put forward are about chronic patients, chronic coronavirus patients who have needed treatment over longer periods of time, patients who have taken convalescent plasma or remdesivir, these antiviral treatments that may have actually induced the stronger viral strains that already had some mutations to survive the treatment, because we don't have a sledgehammer treatment yet. We have nothing that we know can effectively knock out coronavirus. We only have ways to kind of suppress it or mitigate it. And you know, some theorists say maybe that's how we induced this mutation. It was through our own medical advancements to try to save life that we're making the virus not necessarily more deadly, actually not at all more deadly. There's no evidence to suggest that, but more transmissible.
Yeah, it's actually, in terms of, so it's not surprising to me at all that the changes that we see could very well be the result of natural selection. Typically, when you have a rate of change that's higher than you would expect by normal, like natural selection is typically the hypothesis of what's driving that change. There are other like weird aspects of like, you know, genomic architecture that, you know, that could lead to it. But, you know, the most common hypothesis has to do with natural selection. And the scenario that you laid out is the exact type of scenario that you would think would lead to the evolution of higher transmissibility. Now, the evolution of deadlier viruses, that is actually less likely in most cases, right? Because for viruses, you know, we're basically like crops are to us, you know, in the sense that, you know, if you went through and just started eating everything you could possibly eat, using it up as fast as possible, at some point you're going to be faced with a situation where you don't have anything to eat anymore, right? And that's the same thing that's true with viruses, because, you know, viruses, they can't reproduce by themselves. They're just basically like little packets of RNA or DNA with a syringe attached. And, you know, they use their host cells to replicate, right? So if they kill that host off very quickly, right, that replication process, you know, isn't as efficient. It's not able to go on as long. And you also decrease the, you know, the chances of transmissibility, which for the virus is actually a really bad thing.
Yeah. So it really does match up with what the evidence thus far, and this, you know, we're getting new evidence every day about this, I hate to call it the UK strand. They sequenced it first. They found it first. And so we're kind of punishing them by closing our borders to them. But
yeah, although I read like just this morning, I think I read a news article that the novel strain just popped up somewhere here in the US.
Yeah, Colorado. We've got our first case. And I think it's already in like 17 or 18 other countries. So it's this twofold issue where, like you said, it matches perfectly with what we would see in nature because of these pressures that we're putting on the virus, that it's more transmissible, but there's no evidence to suggest that it's in any way makes you sicker or kills you faster. Mm-hmm. And also there's this secondary phenomenon, which is more of a social political phenomenon, which is that we kind of didn't have our shit together here in the US. We didn't have a coordinated viral response. And I've seen a lot of interesting commentary that we have not been doing the best job at sequencing the genomes of these viruses quickly, even though we have the technology and the infrastructure, because it's not being utilized in a sort of concerted fashion. We just simply aren't keeping up with the rate of change and testing the different strains. Whereas in the UK, where they have a national health service and they have a very kind of top-down approach, they've been very good at sequencing the genome quickly, and they were able to identify the 23 points of mutation, that many of them were on the spike protein, you know, that we can specifically point to why or how this virus is more transmissible. And in some ways, we're sort of punishing the UK for being ahead of the science. Like, they were able to come out and publish and say, guys, this is disconcerting. We need to look at this. And the rest of the world is like, you can't travel here. Yeah. And unfortunately, this probably happening under all of our noses, but because we're not looking at it, we don't have that evidence.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's been strange to me to listen to the kind of political strategies around this, you know, around testing, right? It's like, oh, well, of course, like if you test more, you're going to find more, you know, more. Yeah, so we didn't test as much. You're like, wait a minute, how does that make sense? Like, just because you don't test doesn't mean it's not there. You know,
exactly.
They're just like complete disconnect.
It really speaks to some of the real issues we're having in this country, and I think in the West at large about sort of basic science literacy and almost like less about the knowledge deficit problem and more about like a willful ignorance. This idea that like if we don't know about it, we don't have to deal with it being true. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something I deal with a lot in my work in psychology, seeing patients who are who have terminal or life-limiting illnesses, that one of the common forms of death denial is that if I just don't think about it, you know, it's too early to think about it. If I don't think about it now, I don't have to really accept that it's true. Mm. And it's a really sad thing to see when people don't come to grips with it early enough, because then they miss out on opportunities to really live their lives to the fullest and to have experiences that they probably would have wanted to have when they had a little bit more energy or a little bit more cognitive capability. But we often, I think, culturally say, I'll deal with something, like I'll deal with that bridge when I get to, I'll cross that bridge when I get to it, as opposed to like, I'm going to think about how to cross that bridge so that by the time I get to it, I can do it effectively and efficiently.
Yeah. I mean, foresight is always something that's very difficult, right? You know, it's like, oh, are you going to invest a bunch of time and money in something that may or may not happen? When we first got the information, the virus, when it was originally in China, everybody was like, oh, well, it'll never get here, so we don't have to worry about it. And then it started spreading and people were like, oh, but it's not here yet. And you're like, all right, well, I mean, at what point, like, do you actually wait for it to get here? Do you wait, like, you know, how many people have to be infected for it to be, you know, for it to be a serious situation? And the longer you wait, you know, the harder it is to actually get control of those situations. But I think a bigger part of, well, another large part of this, I think, is just the way that we receive information, right? Even for those of us that are curious, that are, you know, that genuinely want to learn, you know, it's harder now than it has ever been in human history to really vet the information sources that you're getting. We're constantly being thrown information from any number of places, you know, Facebook and Twitter and, you know, all these different sources online, and it's all condensed and it's thrown at us by the thousands. You know, literally within a day, you can scroll through thousands of different, you know, news feeds or videos, like going down a video hole in YouTube. And unfortunately, the stuff that you're seeing isn't just a random sampling of what's out there, right? I mean, these algorithms are, you know, sending you specific things and recommending specific things that, you know, they believe will keep your attention, right? But those things that keep your attention may not necessarily be the best things for getting, you know, the right, most informed sources of information.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think historically, curation, there was a sort of trust in a specific type of authority that, you know, although there's a huge benefit from questioning that authority and from really being skeptical and rigorous, you can kind of swing the pendulum too far. And now all of a sudden we are questioning even consensus. It's sort of that, like, we want to keep our minds open, but not so open that our brains fall out. And I think a lot of people's brains are falling out right now. And it's hard because it comes from a place of, like, it's like, when does prudent paranoia transform into denialism or transform into conspiratorial thinking? Like, where is that line where you go from being sufficiently and I think importantly skeptical to into, yeah, denying or believing in conspiracies? And it's, you know, obviously this is just a topic that everybody is talking about every day because it seems to be one of our biggest existential threats right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think generally speaking, you know, the human brain is kind of geared towards, for whatever reason, like thinking that for some reason, extraordinary events have to have extraordinary explanations. Right? And I think it's that sort of thinking that, like, leads to conspiracies. So, like, well, you know, we've never seen anything like this before. Like, this is an extraordinary event. Therefore, you know, something extraordinary must have been happened. Like, you know, it was created in a lab and intentionally released, or that, you know, like, people come up with all sorts of sensationalized stories around this, you know, that they link the two together because, you know, obviously the event is sensational, but the fact that you can get a sensational event from, you know, a normal set of circumstances, right? Things just coming together in a specific way. You know, I think that's a little bit harder for a lot of people to put those two things together.
Right. And I think a lot of that does come down, again, to our emotional responses, our own, you know, kind of evolutionary psychology, and also basic science literacy. You know, it's not uncommon for people to not know what their own liver does. It's not uncommon for people to not know what medications they take, you know, like, oh, it's the white pills. I don't know what they do. And when we're lacking, maybe it's a basic understanding because we lacked the education. Maybe it's a fear. I think a lot of times it's a fear, like, this seems really complicated and hard, and I don't trust myself that I'm going to understand it. Or maybe it's just a lack of curiosity or some combination of all these different factors, but that blunted scientific curiosity, I think we really do ourselves a disservice. I often like to think about scientific education as sort of a privilege. Like, I feel like I'm luckier in this world, that I was able to learn about science and that I can apply that scientific thinking to my decision-making and to how I conceptualize the world.
That's interesting because I think, you know, science literacy is a right.
Yeah. And, I wish, I feel like it could be a right.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, as, you know, I feel like I can, you know, certainly say this as an academic, you know, I mean, we in the academy, I mean, certainly take some fault in that, right? In the sense that, you know, I mean, there's so many people doing so much amazing research, you know, and, you know, a large part of the work that I do in my lab is funded by the National Science Foundation. A lot of people are funded by the National Institute of Health, both of which are government organizations. And ultimately, that comes from taxpayer dollars, right? But how many taxpayers actually know what they're paying for? You know, right. And, you know, so part of our jobs as researchers, right, should be to communicate exactly what it is we're finding. And, you know, I still think that there's a, you know, a huge breakdown, you know, between the academy and like what's being discovered in the academy and then what the normal person knows. You know, for us, if we publish in a big science journal like Science or Nature or something like that, that's a huge success for us. But outside of academics, like I would challenge anybody to like walk into a crowd of 1,000 people and ask who reads Science or Nature as a journal. I mean, almost no one, that if you're not academic.
I'm an academic and I can't read half of the articles in there. I don't, you know, it's like even I do have a subscription to Nature and I love it, but I don't read all the articles. I don't understand, you know, many of the articles. And that's a problem too, that our knowledge becomes so technical and so entrenched that it's not even cross-disciplinary sometimes.
Yes, exactly. You know, which is where, you know, science communication comes in, you know, why it's so important and why, you know, I've decided that, you know, it's going to be, you know, a really important part of what I do alongside my research and teaching as a professor.
Boy, howdy. And that's why I'm so excited that you were able to join me today, because I really want to dive deep into a few pretty specific topics with you. But before we talk about your active research, I really, first, because I think this is a good sort of segue, would love to talk about how you have taken that pendulum for science communication and swung it so far into really communicating scientific concepts in a very, very, I don't even want to say palatable, like fun way, like a cool way to conceptualize science. And that's through the podcast that you co-host and founded, Superheroes of Biology, but also you teach a course on the Superheroes of Biology at UCLA, don't you?
Yeah, I do. So the Biology of Superheroes podcast is, you know, I started it when I was a postdoc with a good friend of mine, you know, who is not a scientist. You know, he's actually in the media world. He works for Warner Brothers Entertainment, actually. But he's a comic book nerd from like way back in the day. And I had a thing for comic books, you know, starting in graduate school, actually, it became sort of a guilty pleasure for me. But I realized that, you know, a lot of that scientific, a lot of like the sci-fi lore that you read about in, you know, in comic books and other aspects of science fiction, actually, I mean, are really interesting ways to approach, you know, some complex and deep issues across the sciences. So we bring those two things together, you know, in the Biology of Superheroes podcast. And right now I'm actually preparing to teach the third iteration of the Biology of Superheroes course here at UCLA. You know, the idea of bringing these two things together, it seems somewhat random, you know, but it's, you know, it's natural, I think, for me in a lot of ways, because it's, you know, science is a big part of science is thought experiments, right? So if you think about Schrodinger's cat, right? I mean, it's a thought experiment. Yeah. You know, it's used to explain, you know, some very specific and complicated phenomena like the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum superposition. But the way that they explain, you know, the way that Schrodinger explained is like you have this, you know, this cat in a box, you know, with some poison, and you close the box and the cat can be thought of as both alive and dead until you open the box and see what happened, right? But there's no weird zombie cat, right? And you know, it's all completely abstract, but the thought experiment itself is useful for understanding the principles of a really complicated and concrete scientific idea. And so basically we use superheroes, you know, for the same thing.
I love it so much. I think it's so brilliant. And it even resonates with me as a non sort of comic book superhero movie nerd. I'm like a different kind of nerd. If anybody who listens to SGU knows that when the guys start talking about superhero movies, I'm like, who's that now? What is his power? I'm always very lost and confused. And I even realized just as we were talking that I called it twice the superheroes of biology, as if there was literally a team of biologists. And they were like the keepers of the biologists. No, obviously it's the biology, yeah, of superheroes. But the idea there is that, yeah, that there's so many ways to explain, I guess, what we often think of it in comic books and in the sort of lore that we see in the films and in the graphic novels, to explain it using biological principles or scientific principles, as opposed to just chalking it up to, let's say, magic.
Yeah, yeah. And there are some things, right, that you do have to chalk up, you know, because again, right, so if you think, you know, you take one of the more sensational characters like the Incredible Hulk, right, it's like, okay, well, you know, automatically run into some real big issues in terms of conservation of mass. You know, you got this little dude, Bruce Banner, turning into this gigantic green rage monster. It's like, but what if we black box that and set it aside, right? And we say, I was like, okay, well, maybe that universe just works on different physical principles for some reason that we can't explain. But what triggers that transformation is typically rage, right? And, you know, you train a lot in psychology, and like, you know, a lot about like how the human mind works and how it processes emotions, right? If you have this event, right, that is being triggered by like a specific trauma, an outward trauma being placed upon a person, right, then there's all sorts of physiological, neurological mechanisms that then have to drive this transformation, whatever that transformation happens to be. Right. So even, you know, with a character like the Hulk, you know, you still get this window into like some really detailed mechanisms about the way the human mind works, about how hormones work, about how we process things psychologically, et cetera. And then even dealing with the fact that you have these two discrete entities, you got this brilliant nerd that's kind of feeble in Bruce Banner, and then you've got this massive rage monster who's, you know, very sort of childlike, you know, in his speech patterns and stuff. And the Hulk, like, almost mirror opposites, both inhabiting the same brain. Like, what, how does that work? You know, and that, you know, if you're thinking about things like dissociative identity disorder, right? I mean, there's very similar processes, right? So as fictional as it seems, it offers really interesting windows to understand very specific things about biology.
I love that. And, you know, I'm wondering, maybe you could share with us an example that is either, you know, like a recently formulated example or one of your favorites that sticks out to you. Because at this point, now you have this full curriculum that you've developed. You've done multiple episodes of the podcast. Maybe you can share with us a particular superhero story that resonates in such a way that you were able to really explain an important biological principle using their maybe origin story or an example with them.
Yeah, let's see. What's a good one? It's, man, this is always a hard question. It's like asking me to choose between my children, right? In a lot of ways. You know, but I think one of the interesting ones is actually Wonder Woman in the Island of the Amazons, actually. Exactly. Yeah, Wonder Woman 1984. Yeah, so when you're thinking about Wonder Woman in this island of the Amazons, right, you have, you know, this secluded island that is populated by nothing but women, you know, who are immortal, who are larger, faster, stronger, have more endurance than you know, any normal human being. And obviously their culture is steeped in, you know, in this, in Greek mythology, right? And being, you know, the descendants to some degree of, you know, of the gods. And so if you're looking at this, you know, this island, obviously this is like a very sort of magical, very sort of mystical, like one of the more mystical parts of the DC universe. But as a biologist, you approach this and you ask yourself, like, okay, like, is there anything, you know, biologically that can actually explain what we're seeing, right? That we can pull from the lore, right? So if this lore is supposed to be some explanation for the biological origins of this group of women, you know, what could that be? It's like, well, we know that in our universe, amongst vertebrates, there are several different species that are completely female. Every single individual in that species is female. And, you know, they reproduce by giving birth to clones of themselves, right? And those clones inherit 100% of their mother's DNA, right? So maybe that, in a sense, can be looked at as immortality. If you're passing on your entire genetic makeup to another version of yourself, right? I mean, that could be seen as a form of immortality. And a lot of these parthenogenic lineages, right, these asexual lineages, are the result of ancient hybridization events, right? You had two distinct species that came together to form instantly a different species because of like differences in diploidy or differences in chromosome numbers, right? So, you know, we as humans, we have you know, two copies of our genome, like one on sister chromosomes. Right? If you take a very closely related species, so say we take something like the gods, right, as a different humanoid species, right, that are also diploid, in some cases, you take those two diploid species and you mate them together, right, because of the incompatibilities, because of the evolutionary distance between those two species, the offspring actually ends up being triploid. So they have three copies of their genome, which makes it impossible for them to mate with either of their parental species. Right. So instantaneously, if you look at the biological species concept, because they can't mate with either of those parent species, they automatically become their own species. And then by giving birth to clones of themselves, right, you get instantaneously like the separate species. Right.
So, right. But you can only do that if you're XX, because an XY.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, because the Y chromosome doesn't carry enough material, right? This is why we only really see parthenogenesis in female versions of species.
Only in the
homozygotic. Yeah, the one where they've got two of the same allele, as opposed to an XY or whatever their version of that might be.
Exactly. Yeah. So for birds, for instance, have a ZW chromosome system. So it's actually the females that are heterogametic. There's ZW.
Okay.
You know, so it would be males in that. Although I don't know of any instances of parthenogenesis in birds.
But theoretically, there's a potential, or it could theoretically be possible, that you would have males be getting males in birds. Oh my gosh, I'm obsessed with this. This is so weird and awesome.
Hey, yeah. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of, like, you know, gamete things that need to be taken into account, you know, that have to be solved for in those situations. So it'd be much more complicated physiologically, which is probably why we only see it, in XXXY cases.
Right. And do you really see it? Where's it most common in nature? I know there have been some examples of, like, sharks and maybe some different reptiles.
Yeah. Reptiles, amphibians, and fish in our universe. And, you know, so, but all that's to say, well, maybe in the DC universe, mammals figured out how to do what reptiles, amphibians, and fish can do in our universe, right?
I love that. In our universe.
Yeah. Yeah. But then the question is, like, does that actually explain, right, the superpowers that were, you know, that were, like, why would they be bigger? Why would they be faster? Why would they be stronger? Right. But a lot of times these asexual lines, you know, if there is, you know, a larger species and a smaller species that come together to create this hybrid all-female species, the females of that asexual species are typically larger than even the males are of the smaller species, right? So if it's humans, you know, if like Zeus came down and, you know, did the thing that he does with, you know, human women and, you know, created, you know, this asexual lineage, right? The fact that they're bigger, stronger, faster than any human man makes actually a lot of sense.
Ah, that's amazing, because they've got this sort of large stature and the strength of the god species that mixed with the human species, that those traits are the traits that are the phenotype of this kind of new species.
Yeah. And when we see in certain like asexual species of lizards, right, if you compare them to their closest sexual species, right, they're, you know, they have better endurance. They're able to maintain high sprint speeds for longer. They're more thermal tolerant. They have, you know, all of these, you know, these high performance, high resilience phenotypes that, you know, that their sexual species don't have.
Wow. I'm wondering though, this is totally off topic, but I'm just interested. Do they, the parthenogenic species, do they find themselves more susceptible to things like disease because there is so much less, I guess, genetic variation within the species themselves? So there's less of an option or a chance to sort of survive a shock to the species.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, right. I mean, in this situation, it brings up the question, it's like, okay, well, you know, if you have the advantage of being an asexual individual and you can pass on 100% of your DNA, right, as opposed to like, you know, you and I, if like, you know, like we have half of our genome comes from our mom, half comes from our dad, a quarter comes from our paternal grandmother, a quarter comes from our maternal grandmother, right? It just sort of keeps getting broken down generation after generation. But if you're an asexual organism, I mean, in number of generations down the line, however far you want to go, it's still 100% of your DNA all the way down, right?
Right. Which some things might be swapped around, but they're getting swapped around with ourselves. Like our genes are swapping with other of our own genes.
Exactly, right? It's still the complete complement of your genome. But what that means is that there's so if that is the case and, you know, you can get these like high performing individuals, then why have sex at all? Right. I mean, besides the fun of it, like, what, you know, evolutionarily speaking, you know, why have sex at all? And that's because of recombination, right? The, you know, the fact that, you know, you can get two distinct genomes or two, you know, somewhat different genomes coming together and mixing, right? It essentially allows us to purge deleterious mutations from the genome, which is a very crucial part. So we call Muller's ratchet. All right. So, you know, through recombination, right, you can actually get rid of deleterious mutations in some individuals through recombination by replacing them with the non-deleterious version that's in, you know, their mate's genome. Right. So you can, so that, you know, those mutations can crank up, but then we can crank them back down. But if you're an asexual species, as those deleterious mutations pop up, there's no way to get rid of them, right? So that ratchet becomes irreversible and it begins this, you know, this sort of slow walk towards genome degradation, essentially.
Yeah, and then you find yourself in some sort of selection pressure. You know, there's a terrible drought or a terrible disease or some other thing where we would need variation so that the stronger or not stronger, but the genes that were more fit within that specific circumstance could survive. And maybe they don't survive and that entire species gets wiped out.
Exactly. Yeah. And we see that, you know, asexual species generally are seen, like if we look across the tree of life, asexual species are typically seen as an evolutionary dead end, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. So I could see then why Wonder Woman and all of the other Amazons need to work really hard to kind of protect their way of life and to protect mm-hmm. their families, because if you lose them, they're gone forever.
Yeah. Yeah. So that may spell disaster for Wonder Woman and the island of the Amazons, but you could also look at it in the flip side, in that, you know, there are other non-recombining aspects of our genomes, specifically the male Y chromosome, that is also degrading. So in a way, maybe the island of the Amazons. Yeah. So in a way, the island of the Amazons may be a future look at the human race.
You're right. Oh, I love it. Coming back around. Oh, man. And it's so, what I love about this, Shane, is that you find these parallels. You're able to communicate these very basic and important principles of evolutionary biology, of ecology, in this coursework, in your podcast, that in your actual field work and laboratory work, you're seeing play out in nature. And so maybe we can make that leap now to what kinds of questions you're answering with your own research. I'm especially interested in the state of evolution today. You know, I think we often hear the sort of misguided concept that, well, we're not still evolving. Nothing's still evolving. Evolution is something from the past, but now we don't evolve, which is, you know, absolutely not true. And so I'm interested in the examples that you study of evolution and really how our own, I guess, how would you word it? Our own being on the world, our own utilization of resources, our own that we've added to the natural picture have changed the evolution, not so much of ourselves, but of other species that we share this planet with.
Yeah. And I think you're exactly right. I think when a lot of people, when you think about the process of evolution, they think about it as, you know, in the sense of history, right? Like this is something that plays out over thousands or millions of years. And Charles Darwin, that's what he thought as well. You know, he thought that, well, you can never actually measure evolution in real time because it's a process that, you know, that it's so gradual and it takes so long. And if he were alive today, he'd actually be quite pissed with himself, I think, because, you know, he was a brilliant experimentalist, you know, and if he had you know, ask that question of like, well, can we actually measure evolution in real time? You know, I mean, it would have led to a whole different series of experiments that he would have come up with before he published the original Origin of Species. But rapid evolution, you know, even in that context, played a really important part of, you know, of his formation of the Origin of Species, which is surprising. You know, for him to say that, well, it takes so long because a lot of what he got about the basics of evolution by natural selection came from domestic species, right? Those species that are a product of artificial selection, human selection. Like he was obsessed with pigeons for whatever reason. Like if you read, you start
because he was English. Species,
it's just I was like, okay, Chuck, I get it with the pigeons. Can we move on past the pigeons, please? You know, but in actuality, you know, evolution is a process that plays out literally generation after generation, right? As soon as you get the turnover of a generation, you have evolution. And that's evolution either by random, right? What we call drift, right? Just the random change in allele frequencies in a population. Or you have evolution by natural selection, where there is some specific aspect of the environment, right, that some subset of a given population is better suited for, right? And because they're better suited for, they're able to get more resources, they're able to find more mates, they're able to have more offspring, and pass their genetic material on to more relative individuals in the next generation. And that, in its basic sense, is evolution, right? As long as you have, you know, heritability, if you have differences in and you have differences in performance, then, you know, you have the raw material of evolution by natural selection. It essentially becomes mathematical more so than biological. It's an inevitability. But we see that play out a lot now, you know, because of humans, right? So we live in what we call the Anthropocene, right? It's the age of humans. You know, it's defined by our impacts on the planet. And we're impacting the planet in so many different ways. And, you know, studies over the last few years, you know, have revealed exactly how much the rest of the tree of life is responding in order to live alongside us, right? So everything from, you know, pollution to climate change to extreme weather events to hunting and poaching, all to invasive species, all of these different things impose novel selective pressures on different species all over the world. So my research focuses on how, you know, human history and culture and activity act as engines for evolutionary change, mostly in non-human species.
Right. I mean, and there's a whole other kind of conversation about human evolution and the ways that human evolution has been affected through, you know, life extension technologies, medical advancements, things of that nature. But even from sort of a natural history perspective, this idea, or I should say a natural modernity perspective, natural nowness perspective, you know, when you talk about the Anthropocene and you talk about this, like, I'm imagining anthropologists in the future, maybe they wouldn't be anthropologists, maybe they'd be extraterrestrial apologists visiting planet Earth and looking at, you know, all of the artifacts of our civilization that, and also doing what we've done historically, looking at the rock layers to determine what was the makeup of the atmosphere at the time. You know, was there an asteroid impact event? You know, what was the magnetic alignment of the time? Unfortunately, I've read some fascinating and depressing papers about the concept of plastic conglomerate, that there's literally so much plastic on the planet now that it's worked its way into our rocks. And you will be able to see a timeline in stone of when humans did what we did to the planet. Because
that's
there
incredible.
Will be plastic
I've actually
layers.
Never heard of that.
It's bananas. It's like, to me, the thing that rings out of, like, that's one thing that's so easy to point to. But that said, as you mentioned, there are all these other things, whether it be climate change or habitat loss or, you know, toxic, you know, poisoning of rivers or all these different things that are putting pressure on these non-human species. So I know you've studied elephants in Mozambique, right? That's one of the kind of key species that you've been looking at. What is the evolutionary change that you've been investigating there?
Yeah, so this basically this has to do with a history of poaching and civil war in Mozambique. So from the late 1970s to the early 1990s, there's the Mozambican Civil War. And during this time, there was large-scale hunting for ivory. And both sides on both sides of this conflict, and that ivory was used to essentially finance, you know, that 15-year period of war. So in places like Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique, the elephant population, it plummeted from, you know, about 2,500 animals to about 250 animals, so to about 10% of what it was previous, and that's a pretty short period of time, 15 years, right? And well, one of the interesting things in African elephants, right, is that most individuals have tusks. All males have tusks. And the vast majority of females have tusks under normal, like, pristine circumstances. But typically, there is a small proportion of females specifically that are born without their tusks and they never grow their tusks. They're completely tuskless.
It's like wisdom teeth in people. Except that's not gender specific.
So tusks are the equivalent of our lateral incisors, right? So you have your two front teeth, and then the two teeth that are right on the outside of your two front teeth, those are your lateral incisors. And in elephants, those are the equivalent of tusks.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And so some elephants, and specifically some female elephants, just don't ever develop those, just from a random, I assume, you know, just a random mutation.
Exactly. And also, interestingly enough, there are some human women that also don't develop their lateral incisors, and they have a tendency to pass that trait on to their daughters as well.
No way. Yeah, see, I'm making the distinction to wisdom teeth, not because it was the same tooth, but because some people just never get their wisdom teeth. They just never develop. But how funny. I didn't know that some people never get their lateral incisors.
Yeah. Yeah. And it has a tendency. It depends on the mutation, but it has a tendency to be very female biased.
Weird. Okay, cool.
Yeah. But in Mozambique, after this 15 year period of civil war, half of the female elephants, half of the surviving females were completely tuskless. All right. So the frequency rose drastically. It was higher than normal even before the war. I think it was about 18%, right? And that's likely because of a longer history of ivory hunting in that region, and the fact that there was also the war with the Portuguese happened directly before the Mozambican Civil War. But nevertheless, you still have this significant increase, and then even amongst the females of the next generation. So individuals that had never, seen the war, there was still a significantly higher frequency of tusklessness amongst those females. So that suggests that that this war, poaching during this war, was a cause for selection for the evolution of tusk loss in this species that then got passed on to the next generation, which is an evolutionary response to that selective pressure. So we've been really interested in why don't these animals grow their tusks in the first place? And the evidence that this change, this rapid change, is actually a result of natural selection and not some random event due to random chance because only so few individuals survived. But the work that we've done, we've done a bunch of population simulations and to try to ask, well, how likely is it that you could get the change that we see just by random chance? And it's nearly impossible. Essentially, the tuskless females had to survive at about five times the rate of the rest of the population in order to get the change, the shift that we see.
Oh, wow. And so just to be completely clear, because I think sometimes the terms artificial and natural selection, I get them mixed up because I often think about domestication as the prime example of artificial selection. So we intentionally choose which organisms to breed because we're looking for specific traits. And then we get the next generation with those traits and we breed those. It's like the Russian fox experiments, for example.
Exactly.
Or the domestication of the dog over time. But is it still considered natural selection if it's an unintentional thing, but we're the ones who did it? So the poachers are killing the tusked animals for their tusks and leaving the untusked animals alone. Therefore, the untusked genes are at a higher proportion in the population and are now more readily able to spread. They confer an advantage, which is I will live because I won't be killed for my tusks.
Yeah. Yeah. So that it's a very interesting question. And I think it's a question of some debate in terms of what to actually call it, in the scientific literature. All right. So it's not artificial selection, right? Because the marker of artificial selection is intentionality, right?
Okay.
You have
a
breeder that says I like this particular thing for whatever reason, right? This bull has more meat and I like that because it'll get me more money. Therefore, I'm going to breed this one, or this you know, this breed of corn, you know, has, you know, more kernels, whatever it happens to be, or, you know, this dog is cuter, so I want to breed.
Yeah. Right? I like his flat face.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, regardless of what that flat face means for how he can breed.
Sad.
You know, so there's this intentionality that's associated with artificial selection, you know, but, you know, natural selection, you know, we typically think of outside of human context. Now, the basic process, right, of human mediated selection, right, outside of artificial selection, like the basic process of human mediated selection and what we refer to as natural selection, there's nothing really fundamentally different between the two, except the magnitude, right, and the time frame, right? So there are predators all over the planet that are preying on, you know, any number of species. And there has been an ongoing, like, evolutionary arms race between predator and prey that have affected the evolution of both. What's different in this case is that the sheer magnitude of predation, like the number of individuals that are being taken because of human predation, you know, i.e. poaching in this case, you know, is so much larger than would be the case without humans, right?
Right.
So it sits in this sort of weird zone that I call unnatural selection, but I won't call artificial selection.
Right. It's like anthro selection. There's something there that it's a natural selection process, but it's driven by humans, so it's amplified. Yeah. Like, just simply because we have the tools, unfortunately. We have just more power on this planet than, you know, the lions, for example, who, you're right, they're natural predators, but they're not also predating with automatic weapons.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like they didn't develop like really amazing tools to become significantly more effective hunters. They just sort of hone their skills slowly and surely over time.
Yeah. And again, that's right, because they exist in this equilibrium, right? If they were super efficient, right? Like if one lion went out and slaughtered 1,000 zebra in a day, well, very soon there are going to be a lot of very hungry lions because there's nothing to eat, right? You know, and you know, but we, on the other hand, I mean, we kill elephants literally for their teeth, right? Which sounds so absurd when you put it in that context. So it's just a very different process. And also, you know, most of the times when we're thinking about this human-mediated evolution, you know, in the case of poaching, it's direct, but a lot of times it's indirect. For instance, like we build cities, right? We build cities for us with complete disregard for pretty much any other organism, right? Like we live in these humongous cities. Like, you know, we live in Los Angeles, but there are other species that live in Los Angeles, not because we designed it for them to live in, because they found out a way to eke out an existence. You know, one of the things that I study are lizards in Puerto Rico that have actually evolved to live in cities, right? Cities have, you know, instead of, you know, living on trees, they live on the sides of buildings. Because they live on the sides of buildings, they have evolved longer legs because they're broader perches. They've evolved larger toe pads, which allows them to stick to these really smooth surfaces. Cities are much warmer than forests, so they've evolved higher heat tolerance than their forest counterparts. And they've done this multiple times across multiple cities. Right? And this is no direct thing that we're doing, you know, to the lizard. Like, we're not forcing a lizard to be in one place or another, but by simply moving into this human modified habitat and finding that it can eke out an existence and actually thrive, evolution comes along and makes, you know, life in that city more efficient.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many sort of big philosophical questions that come from this kind of work. Like, probably the most obvious and the most simple to me is this idea that you can point to these specific examples that you're studying, and it's almost because this is such a kind of new understanding, unfortunately, that those feel like they are the exception, but they're probably the rule. We're probably seeing in almost every species on the planet some sort of evolutionary pressure that we as human beings have induced onto them. Because there's almost nowhere on the planet that hasn't been terraformed, that hasn't been really changed by us.
Exactly. In some way or another, right? And that's like, if you go to the most, it, you know, like the top, if you actually got to the top of Mount Everest, it is probably, it looks nothing like what you would expect because it is covered in garbage. Right?
Yeah. And they found plastic in the Mariana Trench.
Exactly.
Like the right? farthest reaches. Ugh.
So even in the most like extreme, what we would think of as the most remote places, you very readily see, you know, human presence. And humans, we may be the most ubiquitous selection pressure, you know, on the planet, besides like basic things like water and temperature.
Right. Like the sun. Yeah.
Exactly.
But even that is like predictable for the animals. And unfortunately, we can affect change overnight. We exactly. can affect drastic change that's unpredictable for these organisms and that unfortunately they may not be able to outpace with adaptations.
Yes, that is true.
You know, it's the other big sort of philosophical question. I guess it's not even a question. It's much more of a rhetorical thought experiment. Ugh, I don't even want to call it that. I don't know what to call it. I'm getting depressed with myself before I even say it. is that this induces a lot of sort of very existential and even, shall I say, eschatological kind of end of the world scenario types of questions. Because as you were talking about carrying capacity earlier, as you were talking about the concept of a lion not being overly efficient, because if it were, it would run out of food. That's something that we, as we mentioned before, we're pretty bad at foresight. We have not entered into our equation very readily. Obviously, there are basic things. We've learned how to maintain an arms race with pathogens. We've learned how to develop really amazing medicines to counter, you know, some of our most threatening types of diseases. But when it comes to things like feeding the planet, when it comes to things like maintenance of clean water, you know, basic needs that we need the planet to replenish for us, we've just blown through that shit. We just have not thought about how to maintain a planet that, you know, is able to continue to produce and continue to be in a homeostatic state.
Yeah. I mean the world generally speaking, like our globe is only so big. You know, and, you know, we take up the vast majority of that space. Like if we, you know, if you took, you know, the collective mass of humans and all of our domesticated animals that, you know, we have designed specifically for our use and domesticated plants that we have designed specifically for our use, I mean, that would be 99% of the mass of the living planet, you know, and then everything else is elephants and tigers and polar bears and ants and all, you know, all the other stuff, the rest of the tree of life, you know, has to sort of squeeze into that last percent essentially.
And this idea that, you know, that the globe, as you mentioned, is one thing, this idea that in it's a closed system. So there is a zero-sum game. There is an important conversation to be had, an economic conversation to be had. You know, I know that you also know my friend Rachel Ignatovsky. I think mm-hmm. that you guys met at one of our Science and Spirits things, didn't mm-hmm. you? Or am I making that up? Okay. And one of the things that I love about her, one of her newer books, it's not her newest is Women in Art, but one of her books of art called The Wondrous Workings of Planet Earth is that she draws ecosystems in bell jars. Like she draws a full ecosystem, but she puts it in a container. And that metaphor is so important. Because it shows that one change affects everything else within that system. And if we broaden our perspective big enough, the Earth is a closed system.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, you know, and, you know, we're talking about asteroid mining and, you know, doing like all of this stuff. Oh, we're going to terraform Mars. And so it's like, well, maybe we should concentrate on this first before we jump to like, you know, polluting a whole different celestial body. Maybe we can figure out, you know, what is going on here. And I don't think that it's not like we're out of time. You know, there's, you know, a big, like you're talking about like feeding the planet. I mean, right now it's like we have plenty of food to feed the planet. right? If it was actually distributed equitably, like amongst the population. I mean, 60% of the food that's produced in the US is pretty much thrown out, right? Nobody ever eats it actually, right? Yet there are, you know, other places on the globe where people are struggling to find food day to day to day. Even in the United States, there are people that are struggling to find food day to day to day, but it's not because, you know, like we're just eating everything, right? And there's nothing left for anyone else. It's because there's no equitable distribution of the resources, you know, that are available.
Absolutely. I remember once reading, and I have no idea who to credit this to, so apologies. It's probably somebody who's long dead, but reading that.
Or somebody who's going to call you tomorrow.
Right. That drought is a sort of natural phenomenon, but famine is human made. You know, this idea that there are ways, just like you said, to make better decisions from a political perspective, from a governmental, from a willful perspective, that solve a lot of these very human problems, yet we are so in our own ways about it that we can't see the solution right in front of our faces. You know, we continue to use fossil fuels when we very easily could develop the appropriate infrastructure to move away from them, but there's too much political interest in maintaining their use. And I, you know, it's like I see that what you mentioned about sort of there is no planet B, it's something I struggle with on the SGU because the guys are big techno optimists and I love them to death. And they're all about, you know, colonization and they're all about, like, you know, being far flung into space. And I get the passion and the interest of, like, discovering new worlds and developing technologies. And, you know, I get that that inspired a very specific generation and that there is a lot of importance to our space program. But I also think it's going to be a hell of a lot easier to fix the problems that we already made here than it is to make a whole new planet that's not in its current form habitable. So why the hell aren't we doing that first?
Yeah. And if you thought about it, like in a business model, right? Especially like in the tech world, you know, if you were, you know, going to develop a startup, right? You don't develop a startup and you're like, oh man, this has got a bunch of problems with it, but let's also do another startup. You know, well, why don't you get the model right first? Yeah. Find a successful model and then expand, right? And
we're right.
In the process of trying to find a successful model, you know, for how to live in this planet in such a way that, you know, that we won't just completely dry it up. And the thing is, ultimately, right, this is, you know, everyone, like, you know, talk about conservation and, you know, and all of these things as though, right, this is for all the other species and has nothing to do with us.
Right.
In actuality, you know, what we're talking about is going to affect us first, because we are going to be the majority of the planet. You know, like we are the species that needs the most. So as soon as resources begin to dwindle, right, we are going to be the first to suffer. Right? And ultimately, you know, I have almost no doubt that, you know, life, generally speaking, is going to survive humans. The question is, you know, are we going to survive humans, you know, as a species? You know, like there have been 6 major extinction events, you know, and, you know, life has rebounded each and every time, you know, and we are around, like, you know, we are a species because, you know, of those previous extinction events, right? If the dinosaurs never went extinct, mammals definitely would have never diversified, you know, into all the different forms that we see and love, including ourselves. You know, because all of those niches were already filled by giant reptile-like creatures. You know, so I have no doubt that, you know, the rest of the tree of life, you know, in some form, it will look completely different, most likely, but life as a whole will move on, you know, past us. The question is, like, you know, are we going to be able to get our stuff together quick enough to do this for ourselves?
Absolutely. Oh my God, here. You know, Shane, we're starting to run low on time. I hope I can steal a few more minutes of your time, because I know we're coming up on the end of the hour, but
I would talk to you forever.
Love you. You're the best. I'm so excited we're doing this. So I struggle a little bit with the next kind of topic that I want to discuss with you. And I may have even mentioned this when you did a talk at Nexus several months ago, which was like a virtual Nexus this year. New England Conference for Science and Skepticism. Ooh, mm-hmm. I think that's what it stands for. for people who are like, what the hell is Nexus? Which is that I know that you have been endeavoring in a new project, and I know that there's something that's near and dear to your heart to discuss. But at the same time, I'm sitting here as a white identifying, definitely, even though I'm Latina, a woman scientist, science communicator, and I'm talking to a man who is a Black scientist and science communicator. And the thing that I hate the most in the world is when I am interviewed and people are like, what's it like to be a woman scientist? And I'm like, I don't know, like I'm a scientist. Like they're, what are you talking about? And so there's this struggle of like, you are a Black scientist, which being Black in no way affects your scientific abilities, but it absolutely affects your potential for advancement. It affects the way that culture perceives you and has either opened or closed, mostly closed doors to you. And it's one of the very frustrating concepts when we talk about race, because your race is a very superficial and non-biological concept that has massive social implications.
Yeah. So this idea of, you know, of science and race, it's something that I've been thinking a lot more about recently, you know, because now I'm in a position now where I'm beginning to mentor, right, the next generation of scientists. I'm still pretty new. Like, you know, I've been a professor all of 3 years now, but still I'm in a position. Exactly, you know. And, you know, at least I have some semblance of a platform. And, you know, for me, you know, a big part of this equation is just to get people to think about, you know, the issues that are prevalent, you know, in science as a culture, right? And how that can affect science as a process, right? Because mm-hmm. the two they're inextricably linked to each other. I think as scientists, we like to think of science as this sort of, you know, antiseptic island, you know, that's, you know, free and separate from this ocean of emotion and politics and so on, like the stuff that drives the rest of the world. And here we are living in our, you know, logical island paradise. But
we do that at our detriment.
Yeah, it's just not true, right? I mean, you know, science is as vulnerable to our own preconceptions as any other aspect of our lives. You know, so for instance, I mean, just to think about, you know, like, what does it mean, right? For me, I'm a population geneticist, right? And, you know, one of the things that I think about a lot is, like, I have a huge passion for population genetics, like reading the story of an organism's past in its DNA. To me, is just an amazing concept, right? The fact that you can use, like, the very basic building blocks of life to actually tell a story of history is phenomenal to me. And I have a huge passion for it. But every single day, I also have to come to grips with the fact that population genetics and eugenics walk hand in hand, right? They have a history that is completely intertwined with each other, right? I mean, so much so that even like some of, you know, the prizes until literally this year, you know, were prizes for like young investigators were named after celebrated eugenicists, people who published on eugenics as a process. Like, what does that mean for me, you know, to study?
Yeah, like you win the Galton Prize. What are you supposed to do with that? How do you reconcile that?
Exactly. Or to study in buildings named after people that didn't even think I was a member of the same species.
You know,
these are issues that most people don't in the sciences don't think about because they don't have to think about, you know, because it doesn't really have any direct effect on them, but you know, it's certainly on my mind, you know, damn near every day. You know, so for me, addressing, you know, just sort of bringing light to these types of issues and the fact that they need to be rectified if science is going to be an inclusive and inviting community, right, then we need to come to grips with the role that science has played in the history of subjugation of various peoples, right? And that's through colonialism, you know, that's through experimentation, things like the Tuskegee experiment, things like the Auschwitz twin experiments, like all of these things were science, and they weren't like rogue scientists, right? Like these horrible events that happened, you know, like these aren't, you know, people who were like in a basement, you know, like doing monstrous experiments, you know, unbeknownst to anyone else. Like, no, at the time they were done, they were government sanctioned, considered completely moral experiments to do. Right. And so balance.
That's normative.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So just because things are in the past doesn't mean that they don't have effects on the now, which, you know, especially as evolutionary biologists, we should know, right? Contingency. Right.
And we so often sanitize that past when we teach about it. And I think that's, you know, this resonates with me in such a major way, I think in some ways, because our two fields are perhaps the two fields that are most closely connected to the, you know, horrific racist history of the scientific endeavor. That's, you know, genetics, which we know we can, there's this amazing picture that I mention a lot. Somebody had it in their talk once, and I wish I had taken a photo. It showed in a periodical basement of a university library, the Annals of Human Genetics and the year that it flipped over. Oh, sorry, the Annals of Eugenics and the year that it flipped over to become the Annals of Human Genetics, how they just rebranded and renamed the journal and just kept on going. And so, you know, with genetics and then also psychology, you know, a lot of these eugenicists, Bierman and Pearson, I mean, these were the IQ test was distinctly developed, at least in the States, to prove the inferiority of Black people. Like that was the purpose of the test. And so when we utilize psychological assessment and we just simply ignore the fact that there is a built-in bias, not because it's a bug, but because it was a feature. It was the intention. I think it does all of us such a massive disservice.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and that is to recognize that it plays a critical role in the foundation of what we do as scientists, right? It isn't just like, you know, a one-off thing, right? A lot of what we know, right? If we consider like medicine and molecular biology, right? A lot of the advancements over the last 50 years were literally born from the womb of a Black woman, right? I mean, the HeLa cell and Henrietta Lacks, you know, I mean, that was, you know, that simple cell culture, right, completely revolutionized, you know, so many different fields in physiology and medicine and molecular biology, you know, and yet, you know, that family has reaped none of the benefits. Meanwhile, companies have reaped billions upon billions of dollars in benefits.
Ugh, it's so true. I mean, there are these very obvious examples where there are paths to rectification. I mean, you can't change the past, but there are ways to show. And I think the good news is that there are meager, I mean, it's not the great news, but the good news is that there has been, this year especially, even in the midst of the global pandemic, a bit of a reckoning in academia. And there's still been a ton of resistance. And I think we're going to continue to see this fight have to continue. But we are seeing small but measurable steps being taken to, for example, rename buildings and rename prizes to, I think I read somewhere that one of the, a pretty large university who was pretty implicated in all of the controversy around the HeLa cells is, you know, is planning on reparations to the family, which is like, you know, it's not going to fix it. Of course, I think reparations in general aren't going to fix anything, but it's a fucking start.
Yeah. You know, I think, and I, you're right in the sense that like history is history, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not, I mean, like something like that, it's not even really going to soothe over the pain of, you know, no. Of this, of the circumstances, you know, but one of the things that, you know, I try to convey, like, especially to young aspiring, you know, scientists of color, is that that history also inextricably links us to what science is, right? And that because of that history, right, because of those sacrifices, you know, we have a right to practice this process of science. We have ownership as much, if not more than anyone else, we have ownership over this process of science because, like many other aspects of American culture, is built on the bodies, blood, sweat, and tears, literally, you know, of Black people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and how much power that perspective shift has, you know, how much importance that is for a young scientist of color or a would-be scientist of color to hear and to see somebody in your position and to hear these words of empowerment to say, like, what, you know, like it's not just that it's for me also, but like, I am entitled to this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, and the question, I think the question I get a lot is like, well, why would you do this? Right. If, you know, there's this history and there's all these, you know, all these ridiculous things that you have to put up with. And the answer is because science is amazing. It's an incredible, incredible process to be a part of, right? To literally stand at the edge of our collective human ignorance and like look into the vast darkness of the unknown and have the courage to take a step into that darkness in the hopes that you'll find something that no one else has ever found before. And even if it's just that one step, right? I mean, that is something that can fundamentally change the course of human history. Right? And there's something very powerful in that. And there's something very beautiful in that. You know, for me, it's, you know, like that truth, that reproducible, like mechanistic truth of how the universe works, how this weird thing called life within the, you know, within the boundaries of the universe works, you know, finding the truths of that, you know, is like such a grandiose thing. It's something that humbles me and that I feel so proud every day to participate in. You know, and that's why I do it, right? So when we talk about, you know, diversity in STEM and so on, right, it's not just about, oh, it's hard being Black in science, or it's hard being Latinx in science, or it's hard being a woman in science, right? It's the other part of that equation is that what we do is amazing, right? And it's difficult and it's challenging, and it'll give you some of the highest highs and some of the lowest lows of your life. But every day, like, I wake up and feel like I have a purpose that nothing else on this planet has ever given me. And that is something that I'm forever thankful for, and something that I think everyone should at the very least have the option of finding for themselves within science.
And that's why it's a right, not a privilege.
Exactly.
Oh, I'd like to say that I've got goosebumps from that, but honestly, I kind of am a little bit misty right now. I mean, my eyes are a little bit sweaty, I have to say, because that really spoke to me in like a really authentic way. And I'm hoping that others listening, especially those who have been sort of lucky enough to have that kind of relationship with the scientific process, are feeling that sort of profundity in those words as well. Shane, I know that you know, based on what we were just discussing, that there's a project that you've been sort of starting to develop with regards to individuals telling their own stories, you know, individuals of color who are engaging in the scientific process. Can you share a little bit about what your plans are for that? Maybe we can root for you along the way, maybe even convince you to start a Kickstarter or some sort of crowdfunding campaign around it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, it's a project that, you know, came to me actually earlier this year, you know, obviously in the midst of the Black Lives Matter conversation and, you know, all the different conversations that were being sparked because of the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, is this idea of ownership, right? And, right. you know, it is very rare, for instance, you know, like I imagine very few people have ever heard two Black people talk to each other about science and just science. Mm. You know, it's just
it's
a
like
rare
the Bechdel
thing.
Test, right? Yeah. Like are two women talking to each other in a film not about a man?
Exactly. Like,
do they have their own identities? Yeah, you're right. To just in life, to hear two Black scientists talking to one another is yeah. probably something that very few people have had that experience.
Exactly. You know, so this project, you know, it's essentially a collection of stories. You know, it's called Letters to a Young Black Scientist. And basically what I've done is I've reached out to, you know, a lot of colleagues of mine across the sciences, biology, engineering, chemistry, medicine, et cetera. And I've asked them to write letters to younger versions of themselves, right? Whenever that may be, you know, at some critical point in your life, you know, looking like for me, you know, thinking about when I started this journey and all the things I didn't know to expect, all the things like all the highs, all the discoveries that would come, how I would feel about them. I had absolutely no idea, right? So if I could sit down theoretically across the table from myself and be like, oh, dude, let me tell you what's coming down the pipeline. You know, like that letter, you know, to me is something that, you know, it's an interesting thought process for me, but I also realize could be very helpful and informative, not just for young aspiring Black scientists, but, you know, those that seek to mentor, those who will teach, you know, et cetera, an entire community, you know, that is interested in, you know, in the subject matter. Can certainly benefit from. So it's a project that I've just started, and you know already looks to be you know really really interesting. I've already received letters from some of my colleagues that are just absolutely breathtaking. So I'm super excited to see how the project comes along.
Oh my gosh, I cannot wait to read this. I'm so excited. And so I think on that note, Shane, usually I close the show by asking my guests the same two questions. And because this is your first time on my podcast, which is, again, totally bananas, I am really excited to hear your perspectives because they're so varied and they're so broad. And they're big picture questions. So are you ready to go there? All right. So when you think about the future, which that's a big one right now in here at the cusp of 2021, I want you to think of these two different main questions. Number one, what is the thing that is sort of keeping you up the most at night? The thing that you find yourself most concerned about, maybe a little bit pessimistic or cynical about? What worries you about the future? And then on the flip side of that, where are you finding a source of genuine hope and optimism? What are you, you know, authentically looking forward to?
Oh, those are very that's a very big question. You came with the thunder.
I'm like, you have 30 seconds, go. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I think the thing that, you know, I worry the most about is, you know, our collective ability as a species, as humans, to look beyond immediate gain. Because I think that is what is going to be necessary in order to make the large scale structural changes, you know, that are going to be required to save the planet as we know it, right? Again, you know, I think life in general is going to move on. It'll probably look very different, but it'll move on. But if we really hope, you know, to reverse a lot of the, you know, the deleterious impacts that we've had on our planet, you know, we have to be able to look beyond like, well, what's going to be, like, how much money is going to be in my pocket tomorrow, right? And because to weigh that against, well, what is the world going to look like in 150 years? I think that's something very challenging, right, for people to see at the same level. And I think that, you know, collectively, we are going to have to take a much, you know, a much bigger picture approach, you know, to addressing, I think, all of the biggest issues that are facing, you know, the human species right now, everything from hunger to climate change, you know, to different aspects of politics, et cetera, et cetera. It just takes a much more global perspective. And I think I worry a lot about the individual's ability, to focus on that long term and on that large scale and how that translates to collective decision making. The flip side, the thing that, you know, that keeps me up at night in the best of ways.
Yeah.
I think to me are the stories. You know, to me, it's like if you ask any scientist like why they got into science, like what you will never hear is like, oh, like I just really love statistical significance. And since I was 4 years old, like p-values are just the best thing, right? The reason why people get into science is because of stories, a big part of my research, obviously it's about like finding the truth and digging deep into the mechanisms of, you know, of life and why it is the way it is and how it has come to be the way that it is. But the other part that walks hand in hand, like the other side of that coin, you know, is telling these crazy stories. And like that storytelling is something that just, you know, it makes me so happy to be able to share things that just like wacky, sometimes heartbreaking, sometimes super silly, sometimes just completely mind-boggling things that life has done and does every day, you know, both in the context of evolution and in the context of dealing with all the crap that we're throwing at the planet right now, right? These to me are just amazing stories. And together, right, they shed light on who we are, right, as a species. You know, a lot of, you know, we can say a lot about like who we are and what it means to be human, but, you know, I think a lot of it is revealed in our actions, right? And evolution, I think, reveals a lot about the lasting biological implications of human action and the stories of the solutions that animals find, you know, to deal with all the crazy stuff that we throw at them, you know, is amazing. And then the utility of those things for us, you know, in terms of medicine, you know, and in terms of finding our own solutions to solve issues that are critically important for humans, like things like cancer and diabetes. All of these are solutions that many species have already solved in some form or fashion, right? And being able to bring those two things together, tell those stories, make those connections, you know, is something that excites me every single day.
Well, here, Dr. Shane Campbell Staton, everybody. Shane, where can people go to listen to the Biology of Superheroes podcast? Just like anywhere that they regularly listen to podcasts?
Anywhere you get your podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you get your podcast, you can find the Biology of Superheroes podcast.
Awesome. And any other ways that you think people should keep up to date with the work that you're doing or potentially even get in touch via social media?
Yeah. So you can find me on Twitter at S. Campbell Staton.
Excellent. Well, Shane, this has been so informative, so moving. I'm so glad we finally got together to do this. The next time, though, is going to be in person. It's going to be once we've all reached herd immunity and we're feeling a lot better and we can sit down across the microphone from each other. Thank you so much for joining me. It honestly was just a blast.
Oh, this is always amazing. It's always great to talk to you, you know, with a microphone or without. I just love having conversations with you. So thanks for this.
Same. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.